Hey there. Glad you're going to listen to my Harry Shearer interview. Before we get to that, check out my YouTube channel. I've been posting a lot of fun videos. And please subscribe and get subscribers. And if I get a bunch, then I get a sponsor and can make some money, which helps pay for the movies that I make. And also means I don't have to live under a bridge anymore. So, you know, if you want to help somebody out, that's all I'm saying. A couple of random things. Watching NBA basketball. Listen, if you're an NBA player and you miss the first free throw, you don't get to tap hands with the other players, okay? You get a slap in the face and get it right the next time. Get it in. Like, someone should yell at the person, okay? That's the way it was for me when I was a kid, and I turned out fine. So on the COVID front, as you know, I had COVID. I'm technically, you know, sort of out of quarantine, all that. I still can't really taste or smell anything. And there's kind of an upside to not tasting, especially around the house. So like tonight, my wife made chicken parmesan dinner, very lovely. And she dropped a piece of chicken on the floor. And guess who got to eat it? Me, because I can't taste anything. Yes, I am literally a human garbage disposal. So feeling really good about myself. Harry Shearer is my guest, does amazing voices on The Simpsons, Mr. Burns, Flanders, et cetera, et cetera. This is Spinal Tap, Godzilla, just an author, a musician, and he's got a new series out that he's going to talk about. Really cool conversation with him. And it goes in a lot of different directions. It's fun. It's interesting. We talk about the world events, world politics, and all that. So check it out. And appreciate you guys subscribing to the podcast and subscribing to my YouTube channel. A really amazing artist with us today, actor, author, director, comedian, musician, political satirist. If I keep going, I'm going to run out of time. Amazing work on The Simpsons, the voice of Mr. Burns, Waylon Smithers, Ned Flanders, of course, his seminal work in This is Spinal Tap, The Fisher King, Godzilla, The Truman Show. Harry Shearer, great to have you on. I'm really a big, big fan of yours.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk about what you're doing right now, which is you've got an album coming out, The Many Moods of Donald Trump. And right now, what's out is one of the songs off of that album along with a video called Son-in-Law. It's the first track released. And I got to tell you, I had to watch it like three times. I'm like, how the hell did they do this? The motion capture, the lyrics are hysterical. The music and the people you have playing is phenomenal. And what I like about it is I work on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. I used to work on The Daily Show. So, you know, I've been doing political satire a long time, and there's a lot of it out there in the form of television. But this idea that you have of this album, it seems, and this song is a really cool and interesting and unique way to satirize this government, this administration. And explain people maybe why, you know, you kind of decided to do it this way and the process of the motion capture and all that was used with this. It's really fascinating.
Thanks. Well, I do a weekly radio show on public radio, and I make fun of the news. There's a guy who's been in the news a lot the last 3 years. I think he likes people paying attention to him. I think his major strategy is that of most five-year-olds. Made you look. So I look. And I sometimes write comedy sketches about him, involving him and others in his world, called The Presidentist. But I've also been moved to write songs about him. He'll say things or do things that I just think, that's a song. And at the beginning of this year, I realized I'd written enough of those maybe to collect them all. And I went in the studio with a friend who's a producer, and we made, you know, proper recordings of them. And then and they're all in the voice of Donald Trump, first person Donald Trump. And then I thought, I've got to make a music video or two of these, and it's got to look like it's Donald Trump. And I got connected. I was down in Australia just before everything closed down, and got connected with a guy who runs a wonderful little video effects studio in Sydney. And I told him my idea. Can you do this? And he said, yeah. And I came back to L.A. I was filmed doing my performance of the lip syncing of the song as Donald Trump. But then the guys in Sydney did all the magic to turn it into, in fact, Donald Trump doing a music video. And we worked together. This is the way I spent my lockdown, was on regular Skype calls with the team in Sydney, looking at the current state of the piece and then saying, making notes, making fixes, adding jokes, doing all that. So it was real COVID style work from LA to Sydney, Australia. And after a couple of months, we were all pretty happy with it. We're starting on the next one now, as a matter of fact. But so, yeah, the idea was to do something different. I had played other presidents and I'd always worn makeup. I did a TV series about Richard Nixon. I had to be in a makeup chair for 4 hours every morning. And I thought, not that again.
This was really
a good way to do it.
Yeah. It'd also be tough to get anybody to do makeup for you with the COVID thing. I mean, that's, you know, among other things, that's the issues that we're having on the Late Show and why we have to, you know, Stephen's doing the shows out of his house with, you know, limited staff. But Matt Hermans, is that the guy you're referring to in Sydney?
That's the head of the studio, Electric Lens, yes.
Well, are you wearing a motion capture suit? Because
Yes. Wearing the suit, wearing the helmet with the camera, wearing the special gloves, all of it. Yep.
And then there's this deep fake technology to create the photo of photorealistic face. And I'm looking at the face and I'm like, how did they do this? Because the lips are matching and everything. And that is basically, it's a CGI face. If I understand this right, it's the world's first accomplishment to have a CGI face replaced by a machine learning AI face. It would train for weeks on footage of Trump's speeches. Is that right?
That's what I understand they were doing. Yeah. It's a motion capture of my body and my hands and my face. And then, you know, other technologies were applied on top of that.
Yeah. There's some great jokes in it too. I won't give too much away. I love the double salute. I love that.
And
the,
thank you.
And the logo that he has on his, that the people around him have on their mask. I won't give it away, but really nice touches. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, now, are you going to be releasing the entire album next, or are you sort of rolling out songs one by one? What's the plan?
Well, one song a week, starting in a week or so, following Son-in-Law. The next one is called COVID 180, which is about his different approaches to the pandemic as the months rolled by. We'll release another music video probably in late September, and then the whole collection will become a physical object for people who still buy physical objects in early October.
That's
great. I'm hoping we do vinyl as well as whatever other digital format. But
that would be awesome. I'm kind of a process geek, and I'm always amazed by your ability to inhabit another person, either in voice or physically or both. Do you have a particular process that you go through to sort of develop a voice, whether it's an original voice, a la The Simpsons, or you're doing an impersonation, or does it vary from person to person that you're trying to replicate or do?
There's really no process. I either get it or I don't. Mm. You know, I mean, the one time that I really tried working on a character or characterization, I never really felt I actually pulled it off. It was Geraldo Rivera. Hmm. And I just never got it. You know, and I knew what the problem was. It was like, he has a New York accent, but he has the R's of a Midwesterner. And that got me just so far, but it didn't get me to the point where I could do him. And it was really an education into the difference between process and being able to do it. You know, I did everything in the process and I analyzed the way he talked and everything, but didn't click. Whereas other people, I don't even bother with trying to understand. I mean, the reason I went through the process is because I couldn't do him.
Oh,
I thought, man, if I thought about it more, I could do him, but thinking ain't what makes this happen.
Right. And so it usually is sort of, you pretty much know fairly quickly, yeah, I can get this guy or this per whatever at this point and or not. And then once you start to incorporate the physicality of the person, does that help the voice impersonation? Does it all sort of feed off each other?
No. Mm-hmm. I think the voice is its own thing. I mean, yes, there's more study involved when you're going to do the physicality. I mean, I when I did this TV series in Britain involving the Nixon tapes, I went back and actually did. You could call it studied Nixon. Mm-hmm. It reminded me of stuff that I had noticed at the time, but that I'd forgotten in the meantime, which is he had this, for a guy who was trying so hard to be macho, and it was almost comical when you'd hear him, try to swear every once in a while to, like he could prove he, to hold his own in a men's room. And I mean that literally. He had this weird range of motions and gestures that he did were oddly feminine. He had these fluttery hands and he'd flutter his eyelids. There's a lot of fluttering.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Now that I think of it, you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. So study, is useful for the physicality of it and especially the stuff that people don't normally notice. I mean, you go back and look at the guys who were doing kind of the as the British would say, the bog standard Nixon. And they weren't doing that. But I mean, it was fun to kind of see the little other things in that character. And that's what I try to do. If there's a process to the physicality, it's that. It's like finding the things that other people don't notice.
Yeah. Yeah, no, now that you mentioned that about Nixon, you're absolutely right. There was a lot of fluttering and there was a certain kind of aspect to his physicality.
No, he'd purse his lips in a certain way as well.
Yeah. The other thing. Yeah. You're absolutely right. Yeah. You were a poli-sci major in at UCLA and did graduate work at Harvard and freelance journalism and obviously a really brilliant political satirist. Obviously politics is in your wheelhouse for lack of a better term, but were you seriously considering back in the college days and postgraduate work, like a life as a journalist or involved in politics
I certainly thought about it. I mean, I've dabbled in journalism over the years. I made a documentary about the New Orleans flood. I covered the O.J. Simpson civil trial for Slate, the online magazine. So every once in a while I dip into it still. But I thought about it, and thank God I didn't pursue my love of newspapering.
Exactly. You'd be doing something very different right now. You wouldn't be doing either.
I'd be covering things at the food bank. I did spend a year in at state government in California and saw politics up pretty close.
And did you get soured by it, or were you disenchanted, or did it just not have a passion wasn't there for it?
I thought if I'm going to be acting, I'm going to be paid as an actor.
That's great. You did something called a credibility gap, and I'm really fascinated by this. And you would sort of do guerrilla comedy, like alternative live running commentaries at the Rose Parade in Pasadena.
We'd done topical radio. We'd basically broke into the news and did sketches. And so we had an audience in LA, and we'd all been amused by the Rose Parade. And it so happened that the station we were on at the time was co-owned by one of the stations that would televise the Rose Parade every year. And so we convinced the management to let us have a spot right underneath where the TV cameras were for the channel so that we could sync up our commentary with their video coverage. And we went there about 3 years in a row, pre-recorded some stuff, and then did a lot of improv stuff live. I think if we'd continued on, we would have maybe succeeded in destroying the Rose Parade as an institution. So,
sounds like
it's now one big commercial.
Yeah.
I hate to break it to people, but it's now, you know, here's the Minute Maid float and here's the, the Toyota float and here's, and come on, you know, if you want my eyeballs, you just buy a freaking commercial. Don't pretend
Exactly. So, you know, we're going to wrap in a minute and then you're going to jump, but and this is a big question, a broad question. The state of where we are with politics, did you ever think it could get to this point? How, given how steeped you are in political satire in the world of politics, how do you think we got here? How do you think, do we get out of it? Does the pendulum swing back?
Yeah, I mean, in America, you can always count on the pendulum swinging back. You can always count on it swinging too hard in one direction and then the other. I think the two ways we got into this were, one, we had a financial crisis where the big people got rescued and the little people didn't. And two, we made history and we elected the first black president. And everybody seemed to assume that there wouldn't be a real pendulum pushback from that. You know, there's a tendency, I think, among liberals more than other people, to think that progress is a straight line. And America keeps being a refutation of that assumption. And it's like, no, if we're going to do this, there's going to be a pretty big reaction.
Right.
And I think we're living through the waves of those two things combined at this moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you got 300 million people. It's easy for a large swath of people to feel forgotten by whoever is in power. And I think you're right. I mean, I also think, I think cable news contributes to it on both sides of the fence in terms of, you know, sort of it's turned it from, you know, thoughtful discourse into sort of this game of I gotcha, or, you know, my view is better than your view and I'm not going to be open to any other view other than mine. And I think that, you know, for what he is, as a horrible human being and president, he's a brilliant marketer. He knows, he's got his finger on the pulse, Trump, and he knows what plays, and he knows divisiveness plays, and that's what got him in. And obviously he's taken that route again, but I think it's a confluence of events, what you mentioned and other things in our society, where it's just, you watch the news and you know, it used to be the old days, like, John Chancellor or Eric Sarbide, whatever, at the end of their 22 minutes, they'd have 2 minutes of a commentary, but their reporting was not commentary-like, but now it's all commentary-like as opposed to objective. And I don't know, I just think it's all over the place. But
well, I mean, you know, it's the cable networks found during the first Gulf War that if they had one big story like the first Gulf War, and at that time there was only one cable news network, it was CNN, that their ratings got big.
Mm.
So they thought, well, if we did that every day, our ratings would be big every day.
Right.
So they pretend there's only one big story every day.
Right.
That's been their strategy ever since. It's been aided by the fact that these organizations have been thinned out over the years. My favorite story about that is I was watching NBC. I was watching Meet the Press one morning when David Gregory was still hosting it.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, we have a breaking news story this morning from Pakistan. And for the latest, we go to NBC's chief foreign correspondent, Richard Engel, reporting today from London. Now, there was only one word in that sentence that wasn't true. When he said chief foreign correspondent, he meant only foreign correspondent. And
yes.
I think, you know, they've spent the money on showbiz and anchors rather than on reporters and coverage. And they realized that, my God, it's far cheaper to have, you know, one of several regular yakkers sit inside a little box and spout political opinions for 10 minutes with a panel of like people, as opposed to actually having somebody go out and do reporting.
Yeah, exactly.
It's cheaper. And this is what we've gotten out of it.
Yeah. And there's one story, basically. There's really truly about an hour's worth of new news a day, but then they've got to repeat that for 24 hours. And so it's the same model, 4 to 5, then 5 to 6, the next show. And it's maddening.
By the way, you know, the biggest lie we've been told recently is 24/7 news cycle. Cause I know when I tune in the middle of the night, I'm seeing reruns on those channels.
Absolutely. And the structures of the shows, I'm not picking on anybody in particular, but take Deadline on MSNBC with Nicole Wallace and then jump to Cuomo or Anderson Cooper. It's the same from a television production standpoint. It's the same show structure wise. You open with quote unquote the big story. You give us a liberal or if you're Fox or a conservative point of view on it. You bring in four people to then go, can you believe he said that? What do you think he meant by that? And then four people all say the same thing and you go to commercial and it's a waste, but I guess it pays the bills, you know?
It's cheap. That's the main thing. It is when, you know, you can draw a straight line from when the broadcast networks got sold to bigger companies in the, this thing really caught fire in the early 70s. And you had, news organizations in broadcasting were set up to pacify the FCC as to say, we're operating in the public interest. And then you get sold to these big companies, bigger corporations, and the bean counters come around and say, how come this part of the company isn't making money?
Right.
This should be a profit center too.
Yeah.
The way to make it a profit center is to spend less on news coverage.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, that's a really great point. And you know, I said to my wife the other night, I go, the idea of the news was supposed to be to give that person has an expertise and an ability to analyze and interpret and then impart that wisdom onto us, the American people. Now it's just, I feel like I'm watching a bunch of either frat guys or sorority women sitting around going, can you believe it? And then he said this, and can you believe it? And no one parses it because there's no premium or on that ability, or there is no ability at all. You know, it's just, it feels like a big gossip fest at times, you know?
Well, they're up till very recently when I think they've gotten infected with the same thing. I would recommend to people tune in CNN's international feed sometime and see the difference where they have an hour of actual reporting from, all over the world on the news and no panels of people, you know, yakking off, pardon the expression. So it proved that CNN was capable of doing that. They were just choosing not to do that for the American audience for one reason or another.
That's a great point.
The international feed is tending more towards what they do here. But for years, you could tune in CNN International because they were competing with the BBC.
Right. That's a really great point.
And had to do something that more looked like news.
Right. Well, listen, Harry, it's been great talking to you and I'm a big fan of your work. Congratulations on all your success. And I'm sure the new album and the videos are going to be great. Harry Shearer, everybody. Thanks for being on.
Thank you.
All right, there you go. That's Harry Shearer. Thanks. I'm going to go eat some chicken parmesan off the floor, and I'll let you know how it tastes next week. And stay safe, everybody. Wear a mask.